She was refusing to think too hard about the fact that these two strange men, one was in real estate and the other was in marketing, two men, a few years younger than her, living on the other side of the world, presumably with English accents and English complexions, were her half-brothers. It was like hearing that the imaginary friends of your childhood had actually existed all along. When she was a child, she was always asking her mother if her father had other children, and her mother would answer, depending on her mood, airily or tersely, probably. She had created sisters and brothers in her imagination. A sexy older brother who wore a leather jacket and rode a motorbike and had lots of handsome friends. A younger sister who adored her. An older sister who lent her makeup. She'd grown out of it, of course. There was really no necessity for two younger brothers now. She was busy. She had enough trouble keeping up with her own friends. What was she meant to do? Look them up on Facebook? No grandchildren yet, said David. Callum is married, but his wife doesn't seem too interested in having children, and Lachlan seems to be settling into bachelorhood. He stopped and frowned. So this... He made an awkward, sweeping motion with his teaspoon toward Ellen's stomach. So this is my first grandchild. Then he flushed slightly, as though he'd overstepped the line. Yes, said Ellen, trying to be generous.
Who'd have thought we'd be grandparents? Murmured Ellen's mother.
And Ellen watched as her parents, exchanged secretive, loaded looks. Throughout the lunch, Ellen had stared at her father's features, searching for evidence of their shared DNA. She noted the small ears and the good teeth that her mother had put on his list of attributes. She couldn't see any evidence of his strange sense of humor, but that was probably because he was nervous. They all were. None of the three of them were really being themselves. David must have been covertly studying her too, because at one point he suddenly said, I think you have my mother's eyes. That was the one time when she hovered on the edge of feeling something momentous, a sense of loss for everything that could have been, the family she never knew. Grandparents were her soft spot. Your mother who read tarot cards? Said Ellen. He looked startled. That's right, she did. It was a funny hobby of hers. How in the world did you... Your mother read my cards once, said Anne quickly. Presumably David didn't know about the scoring system. Don't you remember? She told me she saw a journey to far-off lands in my future. I think she was hoping I would take a long journey far away from you. She didn't like me much. I think she saw you as a threat, David smiled. She was fond of Jane. Was Jane your wife? Said Ellen. And then she'd flushed, because his wife had been the woman he'd cheated on when Ellen was conceived and Ellen felt weirdly culpable. David cleared his throat. Yes. He lifted his cappuccino to his mouth. Ellen's mother tapped her teaspoon against the rim of her saucer. At the table next to them, two women were looking at a laptop together and speaking passionately about poor response rates. My mother died in 1998, said David. She would have been fond of you. She would have been very interested in your choice of career. She might not have approved of my existence, said Ellen and smiled to show that he didn't need to worry. None of this really mattered to her. She was not a mixed-up teenager, but it was all such a long time ago. Still, said her father. He chewed on his lip. Still, he glanced at his watch. I must run. This was a pleasure, Ellen. I hope we can do it again. And of course I'd like to meet perhaps your husband-to-be, Patrick, isn't it? That is, if you would like that. Oh, the awful strangeness of it all. It was just like the end of an internet date, one where the man was trying to ascertain her interest in a second date, when he was pretty sure he had no chance but thought it might be worth a shot anyway. Of course, said Ellen, all false smiles in internet date mode. He'd kissed them both and left, stopping at the counter to swiftly, efficiently pay their bill. He was clearly a man who always automatically paid the bill.
So, what did you think?
Asked Anne, her eyes on David's back as he left the cafe. He didn't look back. He was looking at the screen of his iPhone as he walked. There was something about the look in her mother's beautiful violet eyes that reminded Ellen of the expression on Patrick's face at Colleen's grave. Was it a yearning look? It made her feel grumpy.
Did you go to their wedding? She said abruptly.
His wedding, said Anne.
His. David's wedding to Jane.
Oh,
Her mother had regained her normal posture and her voice had gone back down a few octaves.
Well, I did, actually. Mel, Pip and I were all there. We were all in the same group of friends. A dreadful day. I felt so sick.
With guilt?
Well, no. I meant because I was 3 months pregnant with you.
Oh, Mum.
Imagine if that poor girl had known that one of her guests was pregnant by her brand new husband.
I'm not sure why you're acting like this is a surprise to you, said her mother. You always knew that he was engaged to someone else.
I know I did, said Ellen. I'm sorry. I just hadn't thought about the fact that you were at their wedding.
She knew what she was doing. She was over-identifying with the bride. It was obvious because she was subconsciously, no, actually quite consciously worried that she might be marrying a man who was still in love with someone else, albeit a dead someone else.
Did you ever think about telling him that you were pregnant? Asked Ellen.
Not really, said Anne. I barely admitted to myself how much I cared about him. I repressed it, to use your language. I pretended I was the tough feminist who just wanted a baby.
But I liked it when you were the tough feminist, thought Ellen. I liked it when you were so different from me. It made me more me.
I thought you'd find this all so romantic, continued Anne. I thought it's right up your alley. I said to Pip and Mel, Ellen is going to love this. And yet, you've been so strangely negative about it all.
My daughter, Miss Positivity. Miss I empathize with the whole world. Even your fiancé's crazy stalking ex-girlfriend. Well, how about a little empathy for your own mother?
My hormones, began Ellen tentatively.
Oh, please, don't give me hormones.
Okay, said Ellen. And then she knew what she needed to say. Her mother had just introduced her to a new man. He's lovely, she said. David, that is. Charming, handsome. I really like him. It was actually not untrue. It was like switching on a light globe. Her mother had glowed.
I know.
And then they'd spent the next half hour talking about David's positive attributes in comparison to all the men her mother had ever dated.
Of course none of those poor, unfortunate men ever had a chance, said her mother. I see that now. How could they when I was still in love with your father? I was subconsciously holding back, wasn't I? I should have let you hypnotize me. We could have worked on my issues.
Like that would have ever happened in a million years, said Ellen. It had been strangely comforting to see the snarky glint in her mother's eyes when she used the word issues. It would have been just too much if her mother had started coming over all respectful of hypnotherapy. Now Ellen pulled up in front of her house and saw all the lights blazing. There would be no fumbling in the dark for the key. The porch light had been broken for years, but like so many other things around the house, it had been quietly, magically fixed by Patrick within a week of his moving in. She'd complained to the girls about his boxes in the hallway. She hadn't mentioned all the things he'd done to make life easier for her. She laughed when she saw the silhouettes of Patrick and Jack suddenly dash by the window, their arms waving in the air. "We're home," she said to the baby. "Looks like your dad and your big brother are still up." She put her hands over her stomach and suddenly, like a message from the future, felt an exquisitely painful, hot, tingling rush envelop her breasts. It was a revelation that her body could experience such new sensations. "Hi in there," this time she spoke out loud. "That sort of hurts, but that's okay. I don't mind. You just rest up. Keep growing." There was that blinding feeling of joy again. A baby. For heaven's sake, she was having a baby with a man who adored her. None of the rest of it mattered.
Chapter 19. Every day, in every way, I am getting better and better. The classic conscious auto-suggestion created by the famous French psychologist and pharmacist, the father of auto-hypnosis, Emile Coué, 1857 to 1926.
"Did you sleep okay last night, Jack?" asked Ellen.
It was a Tuesday morning, a couple of weeks after the dinner with Julia and Madeline, and she and Patrick and Jack were eating breakfast. Patrick was reading the paper, and Jack was being uncharacteristically quiet. He was normally bouncing about at breakfast time, as if he'd banked up a whole lot of thoughts through the night, and they all had to come spilling out as he ate his cornflakes.
But today he was dully banging his spoon against the side of his bowl, and Ellen noticed shadows under his eyes. They looked especially wrong on his smooth little boy face.
"I had a really big long dream," said Jack. "It went on and on for like the whole night. It was like a movie that went on forever."
"Huh," said Patrick without looking up from his newspaper. "Eat your breakfast."
"What was the movie in your dream about?" asked Ellen.
"Armageddon," said Jack.
Patrick put his paper down and raised an eyebrow at Ellen. "Do you even know what that means?" he asked Jack.
"Yeah, of course," said Jack.
"He looks pale," thought Ellen.
"It means the end of the world. I've been looking it up on the internet."
"I'm sure you picked up lots of sensible stuff there," sighed Patrick.
"Yeah," said Jack obliviously. "It's coming, you know. Armageddon."
"Well, it's not," said Patrick.
"How do you know?" said Jack. "You said just the other day that you don't know everything."
Patrick briskly folded up his newspaper. "I know this."
"In my dream, everyone I know died," said Jack. "It was pretty scary."
He stood up and took his half-eaten bowl of cereal over to the sink.
"I'll have to tell Ethan about the dream. We've got an Armageddon club."
Patrick shook his head. "I was in a spy club when I was at school. Can't you change your club to a spy club?" Jack looked at his father like he was deranged.
"No, Dad, I really could not do that."
He sounded like he was about 30, a stressed-out business executive who could not possibly take on another project, as much as he'd like to help out. He left the room, the weight of the world on his narrow little shoulders.
"So, Armageddon, eh? That's a cheerful topic of conversation for breakfast, isn't it?"
said Patrick as they listened to Jack clomping up the stairs to his room. He took his own plate to the sink and smiled at her. "Are you excited?" They were going for Ellen's first ultrasound.
"Yes," said Ellen. "I can't wait to see it.
At the moment, this baby just feels like some sort of horrendous stomach bug. I want proof that there's an actual baby making me feel so sick." She thought, please don't say anything about Colleen's lack of nausea or Colleen's first ultrasound. Patrick went to speak, and Ellen interrupted him hurriedly, afraid she might scream if the word Colleen came out of his mouth.
"So you remember it's at 11 o'clock? You'll meet me there, at the ultrasound place?"
"That's what I was about to say," said Patrick. "We can go together. After I drop Jack off at school, I'm going to come back here and finally move those boxes. When I woke up this morning, I thought, what's the point of working for myself if I can't take a few hours off when I need it? And you've put up with those boxes for long enough." Before Ellen had a chance to answer, Jack called from upstairs.
"Dad!"
"Better go see what Mr. Armageddon wants," said Patrick. He paused and frowned. I wonder if the club was his idea. What would make a kid develop an interest in Armageddon? What do you think? Isn't it a bit...
"Dad!"
The first time Jack had shrieked like this, Ellen had gone skidding down the hallway, her heart pounding, assuming he was lying in a pool of his own blood. Now she knew better. He'd probably lost a sock.
"I'm coming!"
roared back Patrick, and he went clumping up the stairs in exactly the same way as his son, except possibly even louder. Ellen put down her spoon and contemplated her porridge and her conscience. He was taking the morning off work to move the boxes. She felt herself smile, a satisfied, creamy cat-like smile. Oh, she was good. She was damn good. Every day, in every way, she was making him better and better. The smile vanished almost immediately. Oh my goodness, it was a wonder she wasn't waggling her fingertips together while tossing her head back and cackling fiendishly. She was a witch, a manipulative, unethical... But actually, that was all bluster. She didn't really feel any of that. Deep down, she felt nothing but cool, crisp satisfaction for a job well done. The only guilt she felt was over her lack of guilt. It hadn't been planned, at least as far as she knew. She'd had no conscious intention of hypnotizing Patrick into moving the boxes. Patrick had been upset again about the client who wasn't paying his bill. "He doesn't return my calls or answer my emails," Patrick had ranted as they lay together in bed the previous night. "He ignores me, like I'm the one in the wrong. He treats me like I'm stalking him, like I'm Saskia."
"Do you want me to do a relaxation?" Ellen had asked.
After the night before the proposal, she'd stopped offering, and they'd been so distracted by so many things. The pregnancy, meeting her father, Patrick and Jack moving into the house. Patrick had been so grateful, and he was such a good subject, that was the thing. He was like Julia. He had the ability to focus and visualize. He was more imaginative than he knew. She got him to imagine himself climbing to the top of a mountain. He was carrying a backpack filled with the worry and the fury and the stress that the horrible client was causing him. And as he climbed the mountain, he gradually discarded each one of those negative emotions, until he finally took off the backpack completely, and then he reached the summit where he took in deep breaths of pure, relaxing mountain air. And with each breath, he went deeper and deeper into himself. And as she'd watched his forehead smoothing and seen his chest rise and fall as he breathed in so deeply, it felt as if they were together at the top of that mountain, breathing the same air. She talked about how that clean, crisp mountain air was going to help him take clean, crisp, decisive action. "You'll do exactly what you need to do to get your life under control," she'd said, "whether it's calling your solicitor or delegating paperwork or moving those boxes that you've been wanting to move. You will systematically declutter your life so that by the end of the week, you'll feel completely in control, able to breathe, energetic and exhilarated, as though you're standing on that summit with your arms held high. You cannot be hypnotized into doing something that goes against your intrinsic values, or in fact, into doing anything that you don't want to do." She'd explained that so many times to her clients. Patrick wanted to move the boxes. He wanted to get through his paperwork. He wanted to call the solicitor. He freely admitted that he was a procrastinator when it came to unpleasant tasks. Her own self-interest didn't change the fact that he would feel great once he'd moved the boxes. "Bribe him with sexual favors," Julia had said at dinner the other night.
"Refuse sex until he moves them," said Madeline.
Surely a gentle suggestion during an enjoyable hypnosis session was better than nagging or yelling or manipulating him with sex. That was so 1950s. Also, she had not instructed his conscious mind to forget her suggestion about moving the boxes, so he should be fully aware of what she'd said. She would ask him about it. "Did you mind me mentioning the boxes last night?" she'd say lightly, casually. Once he'd move them, of course. No point mentioning it until it actually happened.
"Bye, Ellen!"
Jack came running into the kitchen carrying his school bag.
"Did you get your lunch?" asked Ellen.
She'd taken over the making of school lunches when she'd seen what Patrick had been giving him every day. A slapped-together Vegemite sandwich on limp white bread. Who ate white bread anymore? Wasn't it sort of against the law? And a green apple. He should have protein with every meal, she told Patrick. He'd protested, saying that he wasn't so sexist as to expect her to take on making Jack's lunch just because she was a woman, and he'd been in charge of Jack's lunches for years. And anyway, Jack wouldn't eat anything else. And wasn't Vegemite sort of protein-ish? But she'd insisted, surprised at her forcefulness. As soon as Jack had moved into her home, she felt like his diet had become her responsibility. It had something to do with the sight of his heartbreakingly skinny little boy body. Every time she managed to get him to eat something healthy, she found herself deeply satisfied, her mouth virtually chewing along with his, as if some innate biological need was being met. At the end of each day, she would mentally list everything that Jack had eaten during the day, as though she was presenting a report on his diet to somebody. It certainly wasn't for Patrick. It must be for his mother. "This is what I fed your son today, Colleen. A good mix of complex carbohydrates and protein." Today she'd made him a tuna rice wrap and a little container of fruit salad to have with yogurt. Jack took the lunch she gave him from the fridge without noticeable enthusiasm. "You could pour the yogurt over the fruit," she told him. Jack looked at her blankly. She sighed. Perhaps he was still worried about Armageddon, or else the poor child was missing his Vegemite sandwich. Her attempts to give him a healthy diet didn't appear to be paying off. He looked exhausted. "Are you feeling okay?" she said to him. "Maybe you should stay home today."
"Nah," said Jack. "I'm going to Ethan's place after school."
She met Patrick's eyes over Jack's head. If she insisted Jack stay home, he would make a point of agreeing with her. He backed her up any time she made the slightest show of authority. "Well, an early night tonight, then."
"Definitely." Patrick ruffled Jack's hair in that rough, loving dad way. "And no more looking at the computer without adult supervision. We'll research spy clubs."
Jack rolled his eyes.
After they left for school, Ellen looked at her diary to check what appointments she had booked before the ultrasound. Louisa Bell. How sadly inappropriate that on the day she was going for her first ultrasound, she was treating someone for unexplained infertility. Well, maybe it was happily appropriate. She would put her heart and soul into doing what she could for Louisa. A wave of nausea swept over her, and Ellen looked around for her wellness stone. It was the pleasingly shaped white stone she'd found on the beach soon after meeting Patrick. She'd decided to use it as part of the self-hypnosis she was trying to handle the morning sickness or the every minute of the whole bloody day sickness. The idea was that every time she rolled the stone across her stomach, her subconscious would help the wave of nausea to recede. The only problem was that she couldn't find the stone. The last time she'd seen it, Patrick had been tossing it up in the air while he walked around the house swearing to someone on the phone. The conversation had sounded too serious for her to say, "Hey, give me back my wellness stone." She sighed and made herself a cup of ginger tea instead while she imagined her mother snorting, "Wellness stone indeed. Drink your tea." An hour later, Louisa walked up the path and nearly collided with Patrick, who was barreling out the front door, down the footpath with his arms stretched around a box of random items he'd announced he was donating to charity. He stepped aside for Louisa, nodded grimly at her, and kept walking toward the car. His brow was sweaty and his eyes were crazed. Ever since he'd got back from dropping Jack at school, he'd been working at a frenzied pace, as though he'd been set an impossible deadline he was determined to meet. If you ever wanted proof that hypnosis worked... "Sorry about that," said Ellen. "My fiancé is having a clean-out." "Oh, yes, I heard that you were getting married." Louisa dabbed at her nose with a soggy-looking tissue. She was the very essence of a woman with a cold, as if she'd been cast for the role in a TV commercial for cold and flu tablets. Her nose was red, and her eyes were bloodshot and puffy. Ellen felt her own sinuses block up in sympathy. "You heard I was getting married?" said Ellen, as she led Louisa up the stairs. For some reason, she thought of Saskia. Was she passing on the news to all of her clients? "Patricia Bradbury," said Louisa shortly. Julia's mother. Ellen had forgotten that Louisa was the daughter of one of Julia's mother's friends. If Louisa knew about the engagement, did she know about the pregnancy too? Surely people knew better than to pass on random pregnancy news to a woman who was desperately trying to have a baby. "Would you like me to make you a cup of herbal tea?" she asked Louisa as she gestured toward the client chair. "I could make you one with lemon and honey for your cold."
"So, I'm not pregnant," said Louisa, "but apparently you are."
It appeared people did not know better.
"Well, yes, actually. It's only early days," began Ellen.
"I heard it was an accident," said Louisa.
She sniffed and grabbed a handful of Ellen's tissues. She wiped her nose aggressively.
"It's true that it wasn't planned," said Ellen carefully.
She sat down and picked up Louisa's file, which she had taken up beforehand and placed on the coffee table ready for her session.
"Maybe you accidentally hypnotized yourself when you were meant to be hypnotizing me."
Louisa gave a bitter little laugh that turned into a spluttering cough. "This must seem very unfair to you," said Ellen.
"You said you could get me pregnant," said Louisa.
"I did not," said Ellen. She would never have said that. Although it was true that she did have high hopes for her success with Louisa. Over the years, she had helped a number of women with similar case histories. They had sent her effusive letters and photos of their babies. One had even named her baby Ellen in her honor.
"I want my money back," said Louisa. "That's the only reason I came today. You're a fraud. You take advantage of people when they're suffering, when they're at their most vulnerable. I can't believe you were recommended to me."
Ellen felt a rush of prickly heat flood her whole body like an instant allergic reaction. "Louisa," she said, "I'm so sorry."
"Just give me my money back."
Never ever give a client a refund. Flynn had drummed that into her. "This is a professional service you're offering. Professionals do not give a refund for no reason. Respect yourself, respect what you do."
"You're a quack," said Louisa. Her voice quivered on the edge of tears. "Why should I help fund stuff for your baby? Your baby's clothes, your baby's nappies."
Do you think with all the money we're spending on IVF, we need this extra expense? My husband told me. He said all this alternative stuff is a load of crap, and he was right.
She was sobbing now, rocking back and forth as though she was racked with pain. Ellen's eyes filled with sympathetic tears.
What to say? What to say?
Louisa, I really believe that we could still...
Just give me my money back.
All right, said Ellen. I will. Just give me a minute. I'll write you a check. This was a first. Nobody had ever asked for a refund before. She'd always known that if they did, she would ignore Flynn's instructions. She took her checkbook from the drawer of her desk and watched her hand shake slightly as she wrote Louisa's name. All her pregnancy symptoms suddenly intensified. Her breasts hardened and burned, and her mouth filled with metal. Her body obviously wanted to make her feel even guiltier for being pregnant when Louisa wasn't.
It better not bounce.
Louisa stuffed the check into her handbag. It won't, said Ellen. One part of her wanted to slap the woman and the other part wanted to hug her.
Right, well I'll be...
Louisa sneezed three times in a row. She pressed her sodden tissue to her nose and looked at Ellen with streaming eyes.
Bless you, said Ellen.
Her hand went out involuntarily to touch Louisa's arm in a gesture of sympathy. The poor woman looked so pitiful.
Don't touch me, said Louisa.
She turned and walked down the stairs, blowing her nose the whole way. Patrick looked up from the hallway where he was in process of straightening up while he hefted two giant garbage bags over his shoulders like a weightlifter. He smiled politely at Louisa, and then his smile vanished when he saw her clearly unhappy demeanor. His eyes moved questioningly to Ellen's, and she silently shrugged. Ellen opened the door for Louisa, and she left without saying a word, walking briskly down the path, her chin jutting forward, arms swinging, as if she was on her way to put a stop to something.
"What's her problem?"
asked Patrick, coming to stand beside her at the door. "She's mad at me for being pregnant when she's not," said Ellen.
Who's that?
Louisa had stopped near the top of the path to talk to a tall man in dark sunglasses and a stylish suit.
"Do you know him?"
asked Patrick.
"I don't think so," said Ellen.
She had a strong sense of foreboding as she watched Louisa fling back her arm toward the house while the man bent toward her, listening with his whole body. He was far too interested in what Louisa was saying. Whoever he was, Ellen didn't want him talking to Louisa right now.
"It's not a new client, is it?" said Patrick, "because it looks like she's giving him an earful."
"I'm not expecting anyone," said Ellen. She squinted. The man turned so she could see his face in profile. He had a big, beaky nose. There was something familiar about him.
"I feel like I know him from somewhere." Patrick shifted the garbage bags more comfortably on his shoulders.
"Me too," said Ellen. "Is he a newsreader or something? An actor?" They watched as Louisa reached into her handbag and held something up to the man.
"I think she's showing him the check I gave her," said Ellen.
"Why did you give her a check?"
"It's a refund," said Ellen.
"A refund? You gave her a refund because you're pregnant?"
"I'll explain later.
What's he doing now?" The man reached into the pocket of his jacket and took out something that appeared to be a business card. Louisa glanced at it and then smiled.
"Oh, God," said Ellen. "Who is this man?"
"I'll go and find out," said Patrick. "They can't just stand there chatting on your property."
"No, wait."
Ellen chewed a fingernail and watched Louisa carefully put the man's card in her bag, like she was filing away an important document before walking off. The man lifted a hand to wave goodbye, and then came striding down the footpath, smoothly removing his sunglasses with one hand. He looked angry and determined, as if he was walking straight to the lost luggage counter at the airport.
"Right," said Patrick. He set down the garbage bags and opened the screen door. "Can I help you, mate?"
There was an aggressive edge to his voice. Ellen tugged at the back of his t-shirt.
"Patrick, don't..."
"I'm here to see Ellen O'Farrell," said the man.
He didn't smile. Most people couldn't help but at least give a perfunctory smile when they walked to the door of a strange house.
"Have you got an appointment?"
Patrick squared his shoulders.
"Nope."
The man lifted his chin as if to say, "What if I don't?"
Patrick puffed out his chest and Ellen thought, look at him being all chivalrous.
He
he said. Why don't you come back when you've got one?
This was getting out of hand. Ellen stepped forward. I'm Ellen. Can I? The man turned to her with such hatred in his eyes, Ellen faltered.
Can I help you? She said. I'm Ian Roman. My wife is a patient of yours. Rosie, remember her? You were helping her stop smoking, although, funnily enough, she's still going through a pack a day.
That's why she recognized him. Rosie's wealthy husband. A bigwig. That's how Rosie had described him. He was in real estate, wasn't he? Or some sort of media tycoon? Ellen couldn't remember which. She just knew she'd seen his face in the papers.
I don't care who you are, said Patrick, although Ellen could tell by the subtle change of tone in his voice that he knew exactly who Ian Roman was and where he sat on the social hierarchy. You can't come barging in here without an appointment.
It's fine, said Ellen. I have a few minutes.
She stepped in between the two men and gave Patrick a look that was meant to say, Thank you, my darling, but you can back off now. My office is this way, Ian. She put deliberate emphasis on his name. I can see you for 10 minutes or so.
I'll be just down here, said Patrick warningly.
So this is where you supposedly hypnotize people, said Ian Roman after she led him upstairs. He glanced around her lovely office and his nostrils flared as though he was seeing something unhygienic and unsavory.
Have a seat. Ellen indicated the green recliner and for some reason, perhaps fear, she said flippantly, Have a chocolate too. Ian took a seat and didn't even bother to glance at the chocolates. He pulled on his trouser legs. Ellen sat down in front of him. She was mentally replaying her last session with Rosie. Ian suddenly leaned forward.
So, Rosie has her sister over the other night. I come home early and I stop in the hallway to look at some mail and I can hear them talking. I'm not really listening, but then it starts to register. And you know what I hear?
He didn't wait for an answer.
I hear my wife say that she discovered under hypnosis that she doesn't really love me. Great. But you know what? That's okay. That's no problem, because now she's being hypnotized into loving me. $150 a pop. Let's forget about helping you stop smoking. That's too hard. Let's help you love your husband, the one you married 5 fucking minutes ago.
Ellen took a deep, shaky breath. What was in the air today? She tried to keep her voice detached and professional, yet caring and empathetic. Obviously, it would be unethical of me to discuss your wife's treatment with you. However, I do understand...
Oh, obviously, because you're so very ethical.
There was a thump and a crash from downstairs. It sounded like Patrick had dropped one of the boxes. Ellen's cheeks felt hot.
I am not a quack. I have nothing to feel guilty about.
Except maybe she did. Have you spoken to Rosie about this? She said.
I have nothing to say to her, said Ian. Clearly our marriage is over. I don't need a woman who needs to be hypnotized into loving me. For Christ's sake, what a joke. What an absolute joke.
His mask of controlled fury slipped for a fleeting second, and that was all it took for Ellen to understand everything. He loved Rosie, and he was desperately hurt, but overriding everything else was his shattered pride. That was what was driving him. His ego had taken a violent blow, and he was going to fight back until it stopped hurting.
Never hurt their pride, Ellen's grandmother had once told her. A man with hurt pride is like a wounded bear thrashing about in the forest.
Ellen massaged her stomach. Before she saw Louisa, she'd drunk 2 glasses of water in preparation for this morning's ultrasound. She desperately needed to empty her bladder.
I had the pleasure of meeting another one of your satisfied clients on the way in, said Ian. Great little operation you've got going here. Regularly hand out refunds, do you?
You really need to talk to your wife about this, said Ellen. She floundered. Her professional identity suddenly seemed slippery and tenuous. She saw her mother's face all those years ago.
Ellen, you can't seriously be considering a career in this.
She thought of all the jokes and the sneers and the doubts she'd ever endured. It suddenly felt like she was a quack, a charlatan.
This is not the way it seems. I bet you're involved with these idiotic hypno parties, aren't you? Said Ian. I guess it makes it easier to rip people off en masse.
Oh God, if he knew her connection to Danny. How would he handle this sort of attack,
or Flynn. Both of them would do a better job than she was doing now.
I expect you cure cancer, do you? Said Ian. Forget chemo. Just use the power of your mind.
I have never, ever made unsubstantiated claims, said Ellen. Look, for heaven's sake, I'm not a faith healer. I'm a fully qualified, clinical hypnotherapist and counselor. Hypnotherapy has been recognized by the Australian Medical Association. Doctors refer their patients to me. Although not my own mother.
I expect you give them a nice little kickback for that.
I don't, actually. Although she had sent Lena Peterson a nice box of chocolates for Christmas last year. Was that wrong? Ian stood up and went to the window. He tapped the glass as if he was testing its strength.
Ocean view? This is a great house. Business is obviously good.
This was actually my grandparents' house, began Ellen. She could hear Flynn. You do not need to explain your financial situation to him. Ian turned around to look at her. He spoke gently, almost kindly, as though he was paying her a nice compliment. I'm bringing you down. I beg your pardon? She nearly laughed out loud. It just sounded so melodramatic. What was he talking about? He smiled sweetly. I'm putting you out of business.
Chapter 20.
All that we are is a result of what we have thought. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him, like a shadow that never leaves him. Buddhist quote on Ellen O'Farrell's refrigerator. I was driving back to the office from an on-site meeting when it occurred to me that I was only a few minutes away from the hypnotist's house.
Don't do it, I thought. You've got that meeting with Steve later. A million emails waiting for you. You're in a good mood. Why do you always do this when you're in a good mood?
But I was already turning left instead of right, as if I had no choice in the matter, as if her house had some sort of irresistible magnetic force. I'd been feeling a bit strange about what I did on Sunday. I kept thinking about it and feeling amazed at myself, that I could go into someone else's house and make biscuits. I imagine how that sort of behavior would sound to someone else, like the people I just met at that development site. One of the women told me that she'd spent last weekend in Mudgee, and I thought, imagine if you knew what I did on Sunday, how your face would change, how you'd take a careful step away, how I'd be instantly transformed from fellow professional to strange, crazy woman. It never really felt like I was doing anything wrong when I went into Patrick's house, because it never stopped feeling like home. That's where I spent the happiest years of my life. I scrubbed that bathroom every Saturday morning. I painted Jack's room. I chose the rug for the dining room. It never felt illegal or wrong. I felt like I had a right to be there, even if nobody else would agree. But going into Ellen's house and cooking biscuits and opening the door to angry visitors like I live there, I feel like I've possibly crossed a line. I woke up at 3 a.m. on Monday morning with this thought clear in my head. I have to get help. Therapy. Proper therapy. I have to stop. I even went and looked up counseling services in the white pages on the internet. I wrote down names and numbers. It was the responsible thing to do. And then I woke up a few hours later to go to work, and everything seemed so ordinary in the daylight, and I thought, oh, look, I don't really need therapy. I hold down a job. I'm not suicidal or bulimic or hearing voices. I'll just stop. The biscuits will be my last hurrah, my au revoir gift. That feeling lasted all through yesterday, and I felt great last night. I even went next door and reminded the happy Labrador family that it was garbage night, which was a caring, neighborly thing to do, not the act of someone who needs therapy. They bounced about, all grateful because they'd forgotten that it was garbage night, and they had so much rubbish from the move, and, oh, by the way, how was Sunday? For a moment, I'd completely forgot the mythical 40th birthday party, but then I did a completely believable act of remembering it and saying how it was a great party, and the weekend already seemed like such a long time ago, even though it was only Monday. That's what work did to you, and, oh, ha-ha-ha, and tra-la-la, isn't life a hoot? And today I went to work without thinking about Patrick or Jack or Ellen or the new baby at all. I enjoyed the meeting. It was for a new shopping complex. It's in a great spot, high up with views of the ocean,
and I thought of Ellen's office with those big glass windows and the way the sun reflects off the water. And I told the developers that we need an area like a village square, with big glass windows, somewhere you could sit and have a cup of coffee and see the sky, with enough space for your toddler to run around in circles and pretend to be an airplane. It would be the sort of place I had needed when Jack was a toddler and I took him shopping. It's strange how I still feel like I'm the mother of a toddler, even though he's a schoolboy now and he doesn't belong to me anymore. It's like I'm frozen in time. The developers said, okay, chuckle chuckle, we'll call it Saskia's Serenity Spot, with just a touch of that condescending but flirtatious yes dear tone they get, as if the little lady was asking for a bigger kitchen. But I'm going to fight tooth and nail to make sure it stays there. I'm doing it for the mothers. So I was filled with vigorous, professional satisfaction and remembering what I loved about town planning. And when I got in the car, I had a phone call, and it was Tammy. My old friend, Tammy Cook, the one who let me stay in her spare room after Patrick said, "It's over." She was a good friend to me at that time, taking care of me like I was an invalid. She made me chicken soup and cups of tea, and held my hand while I lay on the bed and stared at the ceiling and tried to breathe, even though I felt like a lorry had parked on my chest. I remember asking her if life would ever feel the same again, and she said, "Of course it will, honey." She was wrong, but still, she was a nice girl, the sort of girl who calls you honey and says, "I love you." I can't actually believe I once had a friend like that. It's like remembering that I once spoke fluent French when now I can't understand a single word. After I moved out of her place and into the duplex, she kept trying to be my friend. She wanted me to go dancing and drinking in nightclubs and bars. She wanted me to snap out of it, to pull myself together, to show him, to get back out there. I remember thinking that it wasn't fair. If Patrick had been killed in a car accident, I would have been allowed to grieve for him for years. People would have sent me flowers and sympathy cards. They would have dropped off casseroles. I would have been allowed to keep his photos up, to talk about him, to remember the good times. But because he dumped me, because he was still alive, my sadness was considered undignified and pathetic. I wasn't being a proper feminist when I talked about how much I loved him. He stopped loving me, so therefore I had to stop loving him. Immediately. Chop chop. Turn those silly feelings off right now. Your love is no longer reciprocated, so it is now foolish. He and Jack were both gone from my life as if they were dead, but that was hardly a tragedy. Breakups happen to everyone. It was the same with Mum's death. Old people die all the time. And she was sick, so a blessing, really. So what that you'll never hear her voice again? So what that you'll never read Jack another bedtime story? So what that you'll never make love to Patrick again? Get over it. Get on with it. Get a grip, girl. Everyone wanted me to hurry up and make myself happy again. Cut my hair, sign up for evening classes. And it was just plain irritating when I wouldn't, when I couldn't. It was no wonder that Tammy slipped out of my life. And now here she was again, after all these years, her voice on my mobile phone sounding exactly the same. Tammy always sounded slightly puffed out, like she'd just run around the block. "Saskia, honey, I'm back in Sydney," she said. I didn't know she'd left Sydney. "You're not on Facebook," she said. "How are your old friends meant to find you if you're not on Facebook, you Philistine?" She acted as though we'd just lost touch the way ordinary people do. She didn't even mention Patrick. She asked if I'd have a drink with her on Wednesday night. I said sure, while I sat in the car and felt the sun on my face. And I thought, no way do I need therapy. I'm meeting an old friend for a drink tomorrow night. I'm perfectly normal. Then 5 minutes later, I found myself driving to the hypnotist's house. "I'll just drive by," I told myself. "I won't stop the car. Jack will be at school and Patrick will be at work, and Ellen will be sitting in her striped chair, in her cozy little glass haven offering chocolates, letting her liquid voice rise and fall while the sunlight dances around the walls." As I drove there, I wished I was still Deborah going for another appointment about my leg pain. It's strange how much I enjoyed those sessions. The pain has been worse again lately. I haven't even bothered with any of Ellen's techniques. Now that I'm not Deborah to her, I don't feel entitled to use them. But Patrick was there. As I turned the corner into her street, I saw them coming out of the house together, hurrying as if they were running late for an appointment. Patrick was wearing jeans. He had the day off. Why? He never took a day off during the week. Ellen was wearing jeans too, and a beautiful long grey fitted coat with cute pom-poms bouncing about on little strings. The sort of coat only someone quirky and delightful could wear. You couldn't tell she was pregnant yet. They looked like a couple. Nobody looking at them would think they didn't belong together. And there it was. That strange feeling of exquisite, tender pain. Delicate but fierce. Like a long, thin, gleaming needle slowly piercing my flesh. Where could they be going? I didn't even bother fighting it. I had to know. If I could just know, it wouldn't hurt so much. I always think that, even though the knowledge always hurts more. So I followed them. I was driving one of the work cars because mine was acting up again, so Patrick didn't see me or do any of his clever maneuvers to get rid of me. They drove to Jack's school. A school concert, perhaps? Or a soccer game? One that I'd missed? I thought about texting him to ask, not that he would answer, of course. But then Ellen stayed in the car while Patrick went into the school. He was half running. Was Jack sick? But then only a few minutes later he reappeared, walking quickly, carrying Jack's school bag while Jack ran to keep up with him. They jumped in the car and they were off again. I couldn't think where they'd be going at this time of day, and my desire to know was now a raging thirst. I was leaning forward now, my hands clenched hard around the steering wheel. My vision focused entirely on the number plate of Patrick's car. I dream about that number plate. Lance from work rang on my mobile and I let it go to voicemail. Following them was all that mattered. I lost them at a set of lights on Military Road when some idiot driver slammed on her brakes at an orange light, as if her sole purpose was to thwart me. I screamed with frustration and slammed my hands so hard on the steering wheel they would probably bruise. It was pure luck that I found them again. When I got to the end of Falcon Street, I turned left onto the Pacific Highway for no particular reason, just because I was in the left-hand lane, and I saw the three of them walking along a footpath. Ellen pointed at a building and they disappeared inside. I found a spot nearby and didn't bother putting money in the meter. I walked back to the same building while pain grabbed and twisted at my leg. When I got to the empty lobby, I stopped at the directory board that listed various business names. Dental surgery, chartered accountants, immigration specialists. It could have been anything. And then I saw Sydney Ultrasound. That's where they were going, to see the baby. The baby. It felt personal, as if all three of them were doing this to hurt me, as if this entire building had been placed here for the sole purpose of hurting me. He would hold her hand, and they would listen to the heartbeat and exchange teary, radiant smiles. I've seen the movies. I know how it works. Jack would see his little brother or sister for the first time. "You'll be the best big brother in the world," I used to tell him when Patrick and I were trying to get pregnant. Jack said he'd prefer a little sister. His best friends were all girls at preschool. "I want a little sister called Jemima," he said, "with black hair." And then he added, "Please?" I was teaching him manners at the time. I said that would be fine. I quite like the name Jemima. I thought, thank God I followed them. Otherwise I might never have known what day it was that they went for the ultrasound. It would have suddenly occurred to me, probably at 3 a.m. one morning, that they must have been due for an ultrasound by now. And then I would have lain awake, obsessing over the details, wondering when it was and where and what they wore. At least this way I had some control. I was still part of it. I still existed. Even if they didn't know I was there, I would know. I could say, "Fancy seeing you here," as they came out of the office. Or I could send a text tonight saying, "How was the ultrasound?" Or I could do nothing at all. But I would be a part of it from the beginning, from that very first pregnancy test, of course. Perhaps they'll make me godmother. Oh, I'm a riot. It was a big, busy waiting room, filled with plump, pregnant bellies and couples holding hands while they chatted softly, and slim women reading magazines while secretive smiles played across their faces. These were all people who fitted as snugly into society as the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Clean, wholesome people who loved and were loved back. I sat down on the first seat I saw close to the door and picked up a magazine. As I did, I heard a nurse say, "Ellen O'Farrell?" There was a pause and then again, louder this time,
Ellen O'Farrell.
I looked up and saw that Ellen had been in the middle of helping herself to two plastic cups of water from one of those water cylinders, and now she was flustered, in that charming, girlish way of hers, uncertain what to do with the cups, her bag slipping off her shoulder as she straightened up too quickly. I saw Patrick and Jack walk toward her, and Patrick took the cups out of her hands while Jack lifted the strap of the bag back up over her shoulder. So grown up, so well-mannered. I taught him those manners. Then the nurse said something I didn't hear, and they all smiled, and off they went down a corridor, the three of them. They hadn't noticed me at all. A woman sitting next to me said, "Are you all right?" I hadn't even realized I was crying.
"If you died," said Jack to Ellen, "would the baby die too?"
"Jack," said Patrick, "what sort of question is that?" They'd gone out for an early dinner at a local pizza restaurant, and Jack was studying the ultrasound photos while they waited for their pizza to arrive. "The baby needs me to be alive to keep growing," said Ellen. Should she reassure him that she wasn't going to die like his mother? Or was he just interested? Or was he hoping she would die? Maybe he was sick to death of the healthy lunches. "Did you eat your lunch today, Jack?" she asked.
"So, like, when Armageddon comes and all the pregnant women die," began Jack.
"Jesus, enough with the Armageddon," said Patrick. "This is why you're having nightmares, and this is why you're falling asleep in class."
"I didn't actually fall asleep," said Jack.
He put the ultrasound photos down, and Ellen slid her finger across the table and pulled them back toward her.
"I just closed my eyes for a minute to concentrate."
"They couldn't wake you up, mate," said Patrick. Just before Ellen and Patrick had been due to leave for the ultrasound, the school had called to say that Jack had put his head on the desk and fallen so soundly asleep that the teacher had carried him all the way to sick bay without being able to wake him up. They'd assumed he was coming down with something, but he seemed in perfectly high spirits now, thrilled to have been given the day off and taken along for the ultrasound.
"You are probably snoring," said Patrick. "Nobody else could concentrate."
He put his head on one side and gave a convincing, rumbly snore. Jack grinned.
"You snore. I never snore."
"Me? I don't snore," said Patrick. "Do I, Ellen?"
"No,"
said Ellen. He did snore. In fact, she was considering earplugs. She picked up the ultrasound photo and studied it. "Mine," she thought. "My baby." She glanced at Patrick and amended it. "Our baby." The photo had a ghostly look to it, as if it was a photo of some supernatural phenomenon.
"Everything looks just as it should," the woman doing the ultrasound had said. "Congratulations." And then she said, "Oh, look, he or she is waving at you."
And she'd pointed out a tiny, ghostly hand, and Patrick, Ellen, and Jack had all waved back.
"You snore like an earthquake."
Jack jabbed his finger at Patrick. He leaned forward with his elbows on the table, and the tablecloth began to slip.
"You snore like a volcano."
"Careful, mate." Patrick adjusted the cloth. "Actually, your mum taped me snoring once. I did sound a bit like a volcano."
Ding! Fourth Colleen reference in the last hour, thought Ellen. She couldn't seem to stop noticing it, no matter how hard she tried.
"There's a volcano in America called the Yellowstone Supervolcano," said Jack. "And when it erupts, pow!"
He banged his fist on the table and a glass full of sugar packets tipped over.
"That's the end of the world. It could happen any minute."
"Really?" said Ellen.
"I don't think so," said Patrick.
"Where's our pizza? Don't they know we're starving over here?
Let's see that photo again." He took the photo from Ellen.
"Have you got a photo of me like that somewhere?" said Jack.
"Yeah, your mum put it in your baby book, remember? You've seen it before."
Ding.
Oh, Ellen, give it a rest. What was the poor man meant to do? Ignore his son's questions? Pretend Colleen never existed?
"I'm going to the toilet," announced Jack.
He always went to the toilet whenever they went out. It was his excuse for wandering around the restaurant, checking out whatever interested him. "I bet he stops right there, where you can see into the kitchen," said Ellen. Jack stopped on cue, looking nonchalantly casual as he pressed himself up against a potted plant, and stood on tippy-toes so he could see over a ledge into where they were tossing pizza dough up into the air. Ellen and Patrick laughed, and for a moment it felt like they were both his parents. Patrick smiled. "Funny kid."
He lifted up the photo and looked at it. I wonder if you'll be worried about Armageddon one day, baby. Or will you be a serene, spiritual soul like your mother?
I'm not feeling that serene at the moment, said Ellen.
What a day. First Louisa wanting her money back, and then Ian Roman threatening to bring me down. I think this qualifies as the worst day in my professional life.
Ian Roman is just throwing his weight around, said Patrick. Don't worry about him. He'll get distracted buying his next television station or whatever.
He paused.
So are you really hypnotizing his wife to fall in love with him?
Of course not, said Ellen. I can't make anyone feel something that isn't genuine. Rosie asked me to do that, and I suggested that we do some work on her self-esteem issues instead. You can't love someone unless you feel good about yourself.
I can't tell you too much, but I just said I would try and help give her enough self-confidence to either leave him or to try and make it work.
Hmm, said Patrick. He looked doubtful.
What? Said Ellen.
I don't know. I guess it sounds a bit airy-fairy.
Ellen felt quite profoundly irritated.
Oh, so now you think I'm some sort of charlatan as well, do you?
Of course not. Look, I'm a simple surveyor, a man of the land. Obviously, I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Obviously, said Ellen. Quick, change of subject.
How about our beautiful baby, hey? He handed her the photo, and Ellen smiled in spite of herself.
After a second, Patrick said, his tone changed. Did you see her?
Ellen kept looking at the photo. She knew exactly whom he was talking about.
Yes, she said. I have to do something about it, said Patrick. With the baby coming?
He pressed a fingertip to the photo.
I've never thought of her as dangerous, but she looked a bit, I don't know, unhinged, crazier than usual.
Ellen thought of Louisa today, crazy with grief and envy over Ellen's pregnancy. She thought of Saskia's face when she walked into the waiting room. Ellen had seen her immediately. She had a feverish, desperate look about her, as if she was hurrying to catch an important flight.
Did Saskia want to have a baby with you? She asked.
Who cares if she did? Said Patrick roughly. There's no justification for this.
I just wondered, said Ellen. I just want to understand.
Family size supreme? Interrupted a waitress. When they got home, there was a message on Ellen's voicemail from a journalist named Lisa Hamilton. She said she was working on a story for the Daily News about hypnotherapy and its claims, and had been speaking to some of Ellen's clients.
I wondered if you would care to comment about some of the allegations that are being made, she said.
Her voice was cold and clipped, full of certainty and authority, with a faint edge of disgust. Ellen put down the phone.
Everything okay? Said Patrick. I think I know how Ian Roman is planning to put me out of business.
Chapter 21. Dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Freud, 1900.
What's that old cliche, all publicity is good publicity? Said Patrick.
Ellen was already in bed and Patrick had just come in from checking on Jack.
This isn't going to be good publicity, said Ellen.
She'd called back the journalist and had agreed to meet her for an interview the following morning at 11. Ellen had talked to plenty of journalists over the years, and normally she quite enjoyed it. Ever since she'd attended a seminar a few years back called Marketing Your Hypnotherapy Practice, she'd actively looked for opportunities and made herself available for comment. Every December she was called up by journalists writing articles to appear in the new year with headlines like, How to Stick to Those Resolutions, we ask our panel of experts. She'd been interviewed for health magazines about weight loss and business magazines about overcoming public speaking nerves. She contributed to a weekly mental health column for her local paper, and she was a regular guest on various mid-morning radio shows. She'd even been on television a few times. In every case, the journalists she dealt with had been, if not respectful, at least perfectly friendly and interested. She was soft news. The human interest angle. Something a bit different for the women readers. A bit of fun. Nobody was really too fussed about what she had to say. They didn't really believe in hypnosis, but they didn't care too much either way. But as soon as she spoke to Lisa Hamilton, she knew that this was going to be a different sort of interview than anything she'd done before.
Her manner didn't even warm when Ellen, in a blatant plea for sympathy, had mentioned she was pregnant and suffering terrible morning sickness and would therefore prefer not to meet too early in the morning. Lisa was clearly not the sort of person who could fake the charm in order to get Ellen to reveal more. If she was going to write an article trashing Ellen, she had to hate her. Ellen had no experience being hated. It wasn't helping her nausea. I remember Colleen saying that they didn't mind if they got a bad product review, because the only part that stuck in people's minds was the name of the product. Patrick pulled back the quilt and climbed in next to her. Colleen had been a marketing assistant. Ellen wondered if she just imagined that Patrick's face automatically softened whenever he mentioned Colleen's name, in the same way that her father's face had softened when he mentioned his real children. And so what if it did? And just what did she mean by real children? How sulky and silly and obvious of her. She was behaving as if her father had deserted her. Was that what she subconsciously thought? She thought her subconscious was more mature than that. I'm not a product, said Ellen, although the marketing course she'd taken had encouraged her to think of herself as a brand. You know what I mean, said Patrick. I just don't want you getting yourself worked up about this when it probably means nothing. It might not even be related to Ian, I've got a big dick, Roman. He owns that paper, said Ellen. I looked it up on the internet. It's too much of a coincidence. Have you called his wife? Said Patrick. She's the one who needs to put a stop to all this. I've left two messages, said Ellen. I don't think she could help now anyway. He's got me in his sights. She paused. Did I just say he's got me in his sights? Can't believe I said that. Patrick didn't answer. He was lying back on his pillow looking at his BlackBerry. He was addicted to it. It made Ellen laugh when he complained about Jack spending too much time on his Nintendo. Jesus, said Patrick. He sat up. What? Said Ellen, thinking Saskia. The bastard wants to take me to court. What bastard? Patrick was still looking incredulously at the tiny screen. That client who was refusing to pay his bill. He tapped furiously with his thumbs. I got my solicitor to send over a letter of demand today, and now this guy is not only refusing to pay, but he reckons he's going to sue us because we took too long to complete the work. What a joke! It's probably just a, what do you call it, a counter move, said Ellen. God almighty, the injustice of it! Patrick's whole body had become almost rigid with rage. He wanted this job fast-tracked, we worked overtime for him, I missed Jack's soccer game because of this prick, and then he has the audacity to say that we took too long? Your solicitor will know what to do, said Ellen. His rage made her feel nervous. She'd always found male anger intimidating. It was so physical. She said, You can call him first thing in the morning. Yes, said Patrick. He turned off his BlackBerry and took a deep breath and glanced at her. We're not having a great day, are we? Ellen pointed at her stomach. Shh! It was a great day, remember? Patrick put his hand briefly on Ellen's stomach. Of course it was. He put the BlackBerry down on his bedside table and folded the quilt back so that it was covering Ellen but not him. They snapped off their bedside lamps at the same time, lay down and turned away from each other, their backs pressed together. Flat pillow, said Patrick suddenly, sitting back up and pulling his pillow out from behind his head. Oops, said Ellen. They swapped pillows and lay back down again. Patrick tapped her leg with his heel to say goodnight. She tapped back with her heel. They'd been in a relationship for less than a year, and already they had so many routines, customs, and procedures. It was like each new couple created a new kingdom together. Saskia couldn't let her kingdom go. She closed her eyes, and Ian Roman's face immediately loomed in front of her, as if he'd been waiting behind a curtain, ready to jump out the moment she tried to fall asleep. I'm putting you out of business. He couldn't really put her out of business, could he? Even if the article did imply terrible things about her, she wouldn't lose all her clients, would she? All the goodwill she'd built up over the years couldn't vanish overnight, could it? From just one article? And for heaven's sake, how bad could that one article be? She wasn't some sort of evil con artist. She hadn't done anything wrong. They couldn't just make things up, could they? Well, of course they could. She thought about all those celebrity articles announcing that Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt were getting back together, when they clearly weren't. But she wasn't a celebrity, Nobody actually cared about her life, whereas everybody wanted Brad and Jennifer to get back together. That's why they wrote those articles, because that's what people wanted to hear. She herself was quite keen for Brad and Jennifer to get back together. Surely this Lisa Hamilton would have enough journalistic integrity to talk to clients other than Louisa. Or did she have no choice? Had Ian Roman called her up and said, "I want this woman's reputation trashed or it's your job"? Maybe the poor journalist had an abusive husband and three small children, one of them requiring some sort of expensive transplant, and she had to keep her job at all costs, so Ellen would have to be sacrificed. "Can you sleep?" said Patrick, his voice suddenly loud in the quiet room. "No."